everyone, and welcome to our continuing Shogun review, spoiler review series here on the Outlaw Nation. I am the Outlaw, John Rocha, joined as always by my co-host from the Cinephiles, and for these reviews, Steve Morris. How are you?
I'm very good, and I'm excited to jump back into the world of the Anjin-san and Torunaga and Mariko. I'm very excited about this.
Look at him showing off that he can pronounce these things so well. Respect to you, Steve. Steve is also, for those of you who are trying this review for the first time, Steve is also a big James Clavell reader and historian. So it's going to be fun. He's been great in these reviews, as giving us what happens in the book versus what happens in the show. And this particular show is the this particular episode is the Eightfold Fence. A pretty powerful episode, I thought, directed by Frederick E. Otoye, and the script for this one, Emily Yoshida, Megan Huang being a part of this script writing process here for this particular episode. Steve, we get more with what's going on with Mariko and Blackthorn. Certainly it all, their relationship develops even strongly, even more strongly throughout this episode, leading to her playing a courtesan who comes to visit him and has sex with him but doesn't admit it in the next day. I don't know. You can correct me on that. We also see how Yabushige is handling this situation there and is back to the village that we had dealt with in the first episode here. We see Omi being more a part of this with Yabushige and questions about Ishido and his loyalty to Ishido or Torunaga. We see Torunaga take off, so not a lot of Hiroyuki Sanada in this particular episode. It's much more focused on the dynamics of this town, coming back to this village with completely different statuses for everybody as we come back into this village and deal with all of that. So what were your thoughts overall with this episode four here, or chapter four here of Shogun?
So this one is the one that's has been hardest for me so far, because the one that deviates the most from the book.
Well, awesome. And, please tell us.
Well, I don't want to tell you too much, because there is. So I would defer to you if you found it to be really.
You tell us everything.
Yeah, but I don't want to spoil next week's episode because there's a huge element.
Okay, fair enough.
When Blackthorn comes back to the village, there's a huge, absolutely gigantic story element that they haven't done. And my gut is maybe they went, that's too much to handle in this episode, and we're just going to delay it till the next episode and compress it. So I don't want to say what it is. Okay. If we get, you know, a couple episodes down and it never happened, I'll tell you what we missed. Okay. But it's one of my favorite parts of the book. So the fact that they didn't do it, I was kind of going, oh, what's going on here? What does this all mean? That being said, the big standout to me that I love, that really they nailed out of the book, is Omi. I don't know if you remember that I said in the very first episode, like, Omi's one of my favorite characters. Mm. And like, you just start to see, because the interesting thing with Obi and Yabushige is Omi is smarter.
Yeah.
Like, he's really the smart one. Yabushige is interesting and cunning, and but we don't know which way he's going to go. And he's really fun to watch.
To survive. Omi plays for the future, it seems like. Yeah.
Exactly. And so seeing him appear, I thought really worked. And I thought all the stuff with Mariko and Blackthorn was great. I thought all that and really, really strong.
Okay, this is very much a Blackthorn focused episode, right? This is very much, now we had said in the first three episodes, it was about establishing the Japanese storylines, the Japanese court, the stuff with the councils, everything's going with the Japanese political situation with all the councils there for the regions. All of that is a part of the first three episodes, right? Yes, Blackthorn is in it. Yes, his storyline is there. But this, I think, is the first episode where it's predominantly about Blackthorn and what's going on with him, right? He gets essentially assigned as he said, a better prison to be in, better living quarters to be in there. But he also gets assigned a consort there, Usami Fuji, Lady Fuji, who is now going to be his consort in the situation there in the house. Mariko stays in the guest house. And we see how that develops. He's also teaching Yabushige how to use the cannon. He is showing his skills and his talent, because he has no battlefield tactics. He's a naval guy. So clearly he was kind of pulling the wool over Torunaga's eyes, and Torunaga does him one better before by essentially making it clear that his ship and his weapons and his men are under Torunaga's control, not under Blackthorn's control. So we see Blackthorn deal with these changes here and navigate these changes throughout, and slowly but surely start to understand where he can find his strength, where he can find his ability to have his voice in all of this, and get respected. And I love the scene with him and Omi when Omi wants the guns and he won't give him the guns, and how Mariko navigates that, and then how the lady Fuji there turns it around on them and pulls the gun on Omi. And then we see Omi's, how shall I say this? Omi's, I won't say Lady Macbeth, but Omi's a whisper of ambition in his ears after he has sex with, I forget the character's name.
Kiku.
Kiko, after he has sex with Kiku, who had just been listening to Yabushige and Omi, Yabushige's advisors, talking about how they're going to navigate all of this with Torunaga and Ishido. So a lot of moving pieces, Steve. New characters being added, new elements being added, some characters getting more time, more fleshing out here in this episode. And I love that. What about the Blackthorn element of all of this? What did you think about getting more with him, Cosmo Jarvis, here in this particular episode, and how this came about for him throughout by the time, and how he ends at the end here with all these two ladies by his side and a knowledge of these cannons and what he can do with them?
Well, this is where it really diverges from the book, and so this is where I'm sort of I'm less comfortable with it. And so a couple of things about it. First of all, the stuff with Fuji-san, they handle great.
Yeah,
it's actually the stuff with him giving her the musket and her holding off Omi, all that stuff, totally in the book. They did it better, I think, in the show. I think was really good. And I love, you know, we meet this character. Mm-hmm. Her husband and her son were forced to kill themselves by Torunaga.
Yeah.
She just wants to die. Then she gets assigned to, hey, not only that, but you're basically going to have to be the consort of this big hairy barbarian. Messed up. And the slow transition that they handle in this episode of her aligning herself with him, I think works great.
Yeah.
In the book, Blackthorn has been in multiple land battles. He is an expert on it and is trained. This whole thing is invented for the show of, I don't really know what I'm doing. I have to come up with something. And then he comes up with using the cannon. Because you know me, I love historical novels. I've read the Sharp novels, the Patrick O'Brien novels, the C.S. Forrester novels. I've read all sorts of novels about these areas. What they're doing with those cannon does not make any sense to me at all. Cannon in 1600 were extremely inaccurate.
Yeah.
You know, like the idea, I mean, they have people where there's like a target and then they're kind of people standing nearby. You wouldn't want to stand anywhere near because you don't know exactly where those can. These are not rifled cannon, which means that they spin the ball, which makes it much more accurate. That's not what's going on. So there are multiple things in this where I go, this isn't right. And what's interesting is, it's like we talked about this in the other episodes, how intelligent, on the ball, perceptive, cool do you make Blackthorn? And in the 1980 television show, it's Richard Chamberlain. He's the ultimate stud, and we're really in his perspective.
Yeah.
And what they did so well was, there's like, oh, he was really caught off guard and in a totally unknown situation in this, and really isn't looking so good. But then in the third episode in particular, we really see, oh, this is why this guy is so valuable. This guy is really pretty cool. And I think we took a step back from that in this episode. And that's sort of what, and in particular, with the language thing, is he's not really learning very much of the language at this point. And so it's, which again is different from the book. I won't go into details about it, but like so there are parts of it that I found lesser than. But the other thing about Blackthorn, as we said, the relationship with Mariko, they're nailing. One other one is, you mentioned Kiku. I'm not going to spoil things. It's her character seems a little bit different from what it is in the book.
Hmm.
And different from when we first met her on the Night of the Screams with Yabushige.
Right.
And so I am curious where they're going to go with her next, because it does seem, and I think because they wanted to establish her relationship with Omi. And so they make them, when they're together, very sort of human, natural, informal, and obviously really, really attracted to each other.
Yeah.
And so that, as opposed to this courtesan, this you know, she's a professional, she's not a geisha because that word doesn't exist yet, but that she is this woman of, I think, the willow world is what they call her. And she's very formal in the way that she's presented in the book, and less so in the way that it's presented in that scene with Omi. So but I really am more curious about what you feel about those elements, because it doesn't matter what's in the book. This is a TV show. It matters how you respond to it, you know.
Well, I like the comparison that we've been doing here throughout these reviews, because it's fun to see how they adapted it and how they adjusted and changed it for the 2024 audiences, because clearly it's working. So many people are talking about this show, and every week more and more people are coming into or coming onto the show as viewers of the show and loving and respecting what they're getting in the show. God damn it, let me move some things around my desk. And I I'm a big fan. I got a big old desk, but I still have to move things around because my hands go all over the place. But I love the fact that we're getting more and more of with the Blackthorn here in this particular episode. And Mariko, as I said, Anna Sawai doing a wonderful job with that character. I mean, that scene with them when she walks upon him naked in the pool or water there. It's a beautifully sweet and touching scene, right? When she's talking, what would you do? I mean, it's something you'd see out of a rom-com. What would you do in a fantasy land if I could take you to my world and show you my world? There's no fucking way he'd get an audience with the queen. It's nonsense. But it's great to fantasize about it and talk about it. And it shows that he is growing in his estimation and esteem, rather, and love of Mariko. His affection for her is growing. And it's very obvious to her as well. So that when she comes to him, and Steve, that is her, right? I'm not crazy. It was dark, but it's not a. It's not.
I don't know, John. It was dark. I mean, how could we really tell?
All right, fair enough. You can hold it back for me, but I love that twist. And I'm sitting there, and she's like, "Oh, me and the lady Fuji thought, or Fujisama thought, we would bring you a gift." And because of the gifts that had been exchanged earlier with the as you said, the musket being given to Fujisan, and then her giving him his father's samurai swords. Now this other gift being given, I thought was fascinating. So ending on the shot of the three of them stand for their relationship and their part of the story in this particular episode, the three of them in that morning with the rain, him sipping what I imagine is coffee, I thought was a fantastic
definitely not coffee.
Okay,
fine. It would be tea.
Tea then. From where we came from at the beginning of this episode with Fujisan wanting to kill herself instead of, or becoming a nun rather, instead of becoming a consort to him. And then her in the end giving her father's samurai swords to him in order, because she does not want to be consort to someone who does not have swords. Seeing the change in the relationship. And now these two women seem to be like they're going to be on his side as they navigate the dangerous world of politics within this world of Japan at this time. So I loved that relationship. But let's move over to Toranaga's son. We got to talk about Nagakado and what he did. Nagakado, in essence, understands, he smells, he susses out what Yabushige is doing. He has suspicions about what Yabushige is doing. Then he takes counsel with Omi, and Omi essentially starts to spill a little poison in Nagakado's ears. And then Nagakado pulls a hell of a move by the end of this episode, setting up the tanks on the other side of the field to destroy all of Jozen's men, Jozen being one of Ishido's underlings, shall we say. And he gets convinced by Yabushige to stay the night so that Yabushige can show him what the cannons do, because Yabushige wants to curry favor with Ishido, that he's going to give him these weapons if things go wrong with Toranaga. And Nagakado turns it all around. And essentially, as Mariko says at the end, launches a war here between Ishido and Toranaga. So your thoughts on how they handle the Nagakado stuff compared to the book here, brother?
I really think it was funny when I first saw him. I was like, man, they cast a really young guy to play this part. I didn't picture him quite so young in the book. And I think that really pays off here, because you really see that Omi really manipulated this young guy who wants to please his father. You know, Toranaga scolded him previously.
Yes.
You keep seeing these things as enemies, and now he gets manipulated for exactly this reason. In my opinion, my headcanon, Yabushige knew that Omi set this up. And so when he's going, no, don't, he's just bullshitting, which I loved, you know, and it's like, I think that's really well set up. In the book, by the way, I think they killed Jozen, and then they basically, all the other soldiers line up and commit seppuku. One after another, that are Ishido's men. And that Blackthorn is forced to watch this whole thing while one, and that each one is the second for the other, because you know, you cut open your belly, but you don't want the samurai to show pain, so there's a dude with a sword to cut your head off before you scream. And then we get to the last one, and there's no one else to be second, and so one of Omi's men volunteers to be second, and because he's so honorable, and the guy's basically like, don't cut my head off too soon, and shows you really how many cuts he can make before, and that Blackthorn watching that is a really like, where the fuck am I brutal experience. I think all that's handled really well. But one more thing about Toranaga that we didn't talk about, I love him at the very beginning where he totally takes over Yabushige's troops,
yeah,
and gets them cheering for them, and in the midst of it just sort of ghosts out. You know, like, wait, where are you going? Which is smart, fantastic. Man. One thing you'll appreciate in the book, he goes, okay, because you're in people's heads in a book. And so you hear Torinaga thinking, it's like, okay, you got to do that thing that you've done many times. You have to win over the troops. You have to connect. And so before the cheering, he walks through and inspects the troops. And because he has this amazing memory, which is something that they would say about Napoleon, is that Napoleon could have fought with a soldier 10 years earlier and would still recognize him and know where he knew him from. And so Tornaga's walking through and he goes, ah, hello. Yes, I remember when you slayed that man in this battle, or you and I were on the other side the last time we fought. And so by the time he's gotten to the end, Yabushige's men are like, this is the guy. So when he's cheering, they're like totally signed up, and Yabu's watching just going, fuck, you know. But I think that sequence is handled really well.
Well, let's talk about this eightfold fence that is the title of the episode here. Steve, we get another beautiful scene with Mariko and Blackthorn talking about the eightfold fence, an impenetrable wall to keep distance from all that society throws at them. Am I off base in thinking that she's speaking from the female point of view, that this is something they create and they're taught from the beginning in order to function and live in this overtly patriarchal society? They have to do these things, and I'm sure quite a number of women would relate to that from numerous generations. And so seeing her speak about this so openly and surrendering that truth to Blackthorn, I thought was a fascinating moment. What did you think of this, and is it different from the book?
It's definitely ideas that are explored in the book a lot. Yes, I would disagree with you. It is because the way it's portrayed in the book is this is a Japanese thing. This is not a male-female thing. Okay. Everybody has to do this. Understood. Because you're the samurai for the Lord who then has to kill your own children. You know, like what resentment you might feel. You know, it's like every element of the society. There's another thing that happens. I don't remember if they said in the show, it's definitely in the book, where it's sort of, you have three faces. You have the face that you put out in the world, the face for your friends, and then the real you that you lock away that no one else ever sees.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a lot of talk about how to separate from the emotion of the moment. And this is one of the big lessons that Blackthorn has to learn in the course of the book, is to, you know, his initial reaction and the European reaction is a thing happens and you respond to it. You feel this emotion and you act. And the Japanese way, as portrayed by James Clavell and as portrayed in the book, is no, you have to separate. You have to create distance between you and that emotion so that you have calm, so that you have wa, which means harmony. And only through that calm can you act correctly. You know, and it's funny, having done Aikido, we talk a lot about wa. And Aikido means harmony, the way of harmonizing with the world or with nature, is that because Aikido is all about, this is the martial artist I studied for a long time, because this is all about using this other person's energy and emotions against them, is that if I want to throw someone, or if I am angry, or if I am competing, or if I am trying, Aikido doesn't work. It only works if you're not trying at all. Because what happens is, if someone feels that I'm trying to throw them, well, they'll stop me.
Right.
They'd have to not know that that's what I'm doing. So there's all of this. How do you bring your emotions into check? How do you control them? How do you hide them away or block them? But now we're getting into this weird psychological area of like, oh, that's not healthy if you do that too much. And that's what I like about sort of wrestling with these ideas, you know?
Yeah. But let's talk about the baby earthquake. Is that something that's going to come up, or is that just a fun little moment that threw in there?
No, it probably threw it in for no reason at all. I don't think there's ever going to be. I think it's just like a little thing that happened. I wouldn't worry about that.
Thanks for revealing that. All right. What about Mariko reading the books? I thought that was really interesting as well. And it's so funny because it seems like that could be the reason to not grow closer to him, but it doesn't seem to affect her feelings for him, as we see by the end of the show, what I think is them having sex, but maybe not. I don't know. It was really dark, but it's a fascinating thing what she's reading in the book. And then it opens the door to her talking about her history, and we get these flashbacks, Steve. So I imagine something is coming to tell us Mariko's backstory. She says, "You don't know my family name. An injustice was done to her." How long has she been holding on to have this revenge, and how is Torinaga facilitating this revenge? I'm going to be so curious to see as this comes along. So does her reading the books, does that come into play later on in the show, or was that just for this particular episode?
She does not read the books in the book. That doesn't exist. Do you remember that I said that they were adding more conflict, which I liked?
Yeah, between, yeah.
That Mariko liked Blackthorn more quickly in the book than she does in the show, and I like that. I agree. I think her reading the books is a really good idea. I agree with you. I think the timing is misplaced.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't, it's too close on them having that amazing scene when he's bathing and she's talking and it's so intimate. And it's like, no, this, if she'd read it earlier, it could have consequences with more conflict between them. But we had her read the book, but then didn't really have much conflict. So that's strange. And yes, there's a backstory here. I think they did a beautiful job at hinting at something that was important, but what exactly that is and when it's going to get revealed, I don't know. If it's like the book, it will be revealed. My gut would be next episode would be when it was revealed, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It'd be different.
What about the Natto? Is that going to come into play in any way, shape or form? Or is that just kind
not
of
in the book? Never. I think it was a funny moment. You know, there is a lot of many cultures have some weird ass food that unless you grew up in it, it's pretty weird. Like if you take some real stinky cheese to China and say, hey, try this out, they'd be like, what the hell are you eating? And if you take stinky tofu or nada to most Americans and say, try this out, it's like, no way. You know,
Well, I liked it because I think it was a foreshadowing of what we were going to see later with the three of them together. Now it seemed like, and the fact that he wants to eat their food, I think is a fascinating thing because he is not a conventional Japanese male approach to it. He is much more open. He seems available to these two women, doesn't see them as lesser than, and so he's creating allies and partnerships with these two women, and they have come to step forward and defend him. So I think I'm going to be real interested to see how that bears fruit as the show goes along with these characters. Is there anything more that we missed that we should hit on, Steve, that you have in your notes that we should talk about? Oh, I do want to say one thing. I wonder if Edward Zwick owes an apology here from The Last Samurai to Shogun, because this idea of the woman who's lost her husband, who was killed in battle and gives her samurai sword and armor to the gaijin who comes into her home, rejects the fact that he's been put in her home, sounds very similar to what happens here in this particular episode with Blackthorn and Lady Fuji or Fuji-san. So I thought that they can borrow that little subplot in Last Samurai with Tom Cruise from this movie, a book, it seems, Steve.
Look, I don't think there's any Last Samurai without Shogun. But I also don't think there's any Shogun without, like, I think it's Yoshimoto who wrote the Musashi Miyamoto books. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like we're all stealing from each other. But yes, I mean, I remember when I went to see Last Samurai and was saying, well, and it's also, by the way, so Last Samurai takes place at the same time of James Clavell's last and one of his least good books, which is Gaijin, which is about the American opening of Japan. And so it's like 1870s, 1880s. And so that, you know, these are fascinating eras in history and we keep going back to them, which isn't surprising to me.
Final thing. You know. All right. Any final words on this as we wrap up our review of this particular episode? Any final thoughts, comments?
This is my least favorite of the episodes just because it's the farthest from the book. Okay. But that's why I go, like, I don't know that I'm the best judge. That being said, the show's killing it. You know, they really are.
Well, I loved this episode. We finally got to slow down a little bit, get some more time with Blackthorn, flesh out the relationship with him and Lady Mariko and where that's going, and seeing Yabushige, getting more time with Yabushige and the way he's playing both sides of the fence. And as you said, getting Omi now coming to be a person who is moving to the front and center of this ensemble of characters and actors to see what his role is going to be all with this, with Kiku. And then, of course, with the Torunaga's son, what his role is going to be in all of this and how his actions here at the end are going to resonate as we go forward in the show. So I really love this episode. And so I'm looking forward to see what more we're going to get here, especially after episode 5, because as you said, if there's something big coming in episode 5 that did not show in episode 4, maybe they look at it as a mid-season break and leaving you with a massive cliffhanger to think about before we dive into the last 5 episodes. So that'll be fun to see as well. Well, let us know what you thought about this episode. What'd you think of the political machinations throughout this thing? What'd you think of the emotional attachments and the fleshing out of these relationships a bit more, where they're leading to? What scenes stood out to you? What moments stood out to you? Is there anything, Steve, and I missed that you want to have questions about ask them down below. Steve and I will take a look at them. We can answer them. We'll answer them there down below as well. Thanks to everybody who's been watching these reviews. They really mean a lot, leaving wonderful compliments. Please make sure you hit a like on this video, share it on your social media, subscribe to the channel. That's really big. Subscribe and hit that bell button so you don't miss any notification of these reviews and other things we do here on the Outlaw Nation channel. Steve, thanks again for taking the time to hang out with me today and talk about this stuff. I always love talking about it with you. You have such joy and passion with this that it means a lot when we dive into these episodes. And I think I speak for all the viewers that you give us more to consider and more to think about comparing it to the book, which we appreciate madly. Where can they find you, brother, and everything you got going on?
SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram, and of course, the Cinephiles podcast with my great partner, John Rocha, where we're in the midst of the season of Scorsese, finishing up Raging Bull with our third part this week and jumping into The Last Temptation of Christ coming up soon. So lots of exciting. Oh, and our 10 days of Oscars where we're going through all the Oscar best pictures. So there's lots and lots of exciting things going on the Cinephiles.
Absolutely. And we have a Cinephiles YouTube channel you can go subscribe to as well to get those 10 days of Oscars on camera. And we also put up our episodes in case you don't want to listen to it in a podcast format. You can just put it on YouTube and listen to us talk about these movies and break them down every week on the Cinephiles. All right. As for me, at The Rocha Says, Twitter and Instagram, y'all take care of yourselves. Be well, and I'll see you back next week for episode 5 here of season 1 of Shogun. Take care until then. Peace.